Eric came to us with a very specific proposition, which evolves around how fields individuals relate to society today. His interest is especially in what he calls unspecialized knowledge. And his suggestion is that, as individuals, in our day-to-day encounters with the world, we rely on different forms of knowledge and experience. There's the knowledge that we inherit from our education, that we inherit from schools, that one could say is the learned knowledge. There's the personal experience that we all have, and there is, in fact, a lot that we don't really know. Eric's proposition is that what we do in our day-to-day encounter with the world is to navigate through these different zones, to make our own improvised and continuously updated understandings of the world we inhabit. And what we're trying to do with this project is to assemble those improvised understandings that each of us has, what he calls personal theories, into an encyclopedia and recognize them as descriptions of the world we inhabit today. This is a view of the exhibition. The means to assemble those personal theories is, first of all, a continuous series of interviews. So we've brought together a team of young anthropologists that since September have gone out in the city of Amsterdam to ask people the most diverse questions and to kind of trigger them to share their personal theories with us. Now that the exhibition is open, we also continue these interviews in the museum, so that enhances the fact that it's really a center for producing knowledge today and not just showing it. Eric has developed by now about 800 different questions that we can ask the people. And the questions are very different. I'm showing you a few here. It could be, what gives value to a signature? Is it possible to speak from experience? What is a perfect system? What does it mean to be creative? And in a way, you can already sense that they are all questions that do not have one correct answer. In effect, actually, what Eric has suggested to us is also that we don't have any correct answer to most of the things we deal with in the world today. If I ask you what is intuition, you have a working understanding of it, you rely on it, you can talk to each other about it. But if I really ask you to describe what it is, we might get quite different answers from each of you. And already with such an obvious notion, this would happen. If I would ask, in Eric's line, what influence does the NASDAQ index have on your personal bank account? You probably have some sort of opinionated view on how these larger economic processes work, but if I actually ask you to describe how this works, what we get is people's personal theories and understandings of how these patterns might work. So through a game of questions and interviews, we invite people to share those personal thoughts with us. The idea is not that we get the correct answer to the question we're asking. In fact, if a question invites somebody to speculate and arrive quite somewhere else than where the question started, that is absolutely fine, and this is actually what happens quite a lot. An example of one of the first personal theories we gathered in Amsterdam is this one. It is a story that was given by a woman in the street. And she started speculating on how the physical environment influences how people think. And her suggestion was, or her theory was, that if cities have very many narrow streets, this produces narrow minds and narrow ways of thinking. If cities have very broad streets, Berlin was her example, then people can be more relaxed and it might open people's minds. It was a lovely little theory, quite concise, because it kind of speaks to the imagination. It's a very clear example of something that probably isn't provable as a correct truth, but nonetheless is quite believable and triggers our own imagination and questioning of what actually is the effect of the physical environment on the space in people's heads. And at the same time, I chose this example because it kind of helps us understand why Eric Beltan is so interested in gathering these stories. In the end, we have a growing collection of such stories about the most diverse topics, because an encyclopedia, of course, has to talk about diverse topics. And the stories tell something in themselves, but they can also be read on another level. They start together, slowly speaking about the cultural mentality of a place. And that's something that's a cultural pattern that kind of comes through in the collection of stories itself. And in this case, for example, what you could recognize in this story is that a question that lives in the minds of people in Amsterdam is why Amsterdam is becoming more narrow-minded. And that in itself is a political thought, of course. And her explanation in this case relates to the city. So it's kind of, you can also read it as a search for trying to understand why people are seem to become more narrow-minded. It's been interesting to do this process in Amsterdam, as Eric has done a similar project in Sao Paulo at the Sao Paulo Biennial in 2009 and in Barcelona at MACBA in 2010. We had, first of all, feared that people in Amsterdam would not talk so easily. And secondly, we had feared that if they would talk, they would talk about the problems in contemporary politics. Neither of these two things happened. People were extremely willing to talk and extremely positively triggered by a question like, can flies dream? And we wondered why that is. And what seems to happen is that just the invitation to share a moment of exchange with another individual about a question that is not a questionnaire about your opinion, nor a marketing tool that triggers new commercial products straight away, but that is not doesn't really fit in either of those schemes, is really actually a little gift that people appreciate and that they even thank our interviewers for in the end. And hence it also suggests how these kind of almost unanswerable, sometimes at first sight seemingly nonsensical questions really do invite people to speculate with an open mind in ways that they otherwise would not. Interestingly enough, direct politics never came into the picture in the 3 months that we have been going. Of course, in the narrow mind, there is a taste of it there. But people have talked about evolution, emotion, and much more sort of general, under the surface, larger human questions in a way than the most obvious things you would expect when you read the newspapers. Gathering these stories over the months means that we also, in the meantime, design them into encyclopedia pages, which are being handed out now. It's kind of modeled loosely on an 18th century encyclopedia. This is just a little sample with one page from Sao Paulo and one page from the Amsterdam stories out of a growing set that will eventually result in a book, a bound book of about 300 pages, where the three cities, Sao Paulo, Barcelona and Amsterdam, are brought together, can also be compared, and we're also inviting people to comment on what they read. Now, the interesting thing in bringing a project like this to an environment like the Tolope Museum, which is a culture museum, is that through this project, in a way, we can provide very new ways of looking at very old questions for a culture museum. A culture museum traditionally asks itself, what is culture? How can it be depicted, and how can one involve the people that it's talking about into the production of that image? And this is literally, of course, in essence, what Eric is offering us here. Some contrasts that may not have been so obvious in a wide cube setting do become obvious in this setting. This project is inhabiting a culture museum, which still, until today, although we are working on a refurbishment where this would no longer be the case, but is organized in geographic areas. There's an Africa department, there's a Middle East department, there's a Latin America department. Of course, there is no Europe department, because there never was in this type of museum. But let's say that it inhabits a space that still has this geographical mapping of culture onto places, if not to say geopolitical mapping of culture onto places, and where, despite all the self-criticism that is present in that kind of museum following the self-critical move within the discipline of anthropology, still always run the risks of linking what people might think and how they might inhabit the world to identifiable ethnic groups. And in this case, of course, we are making a portrait of Amsterdam and of the mentality of Amsterdam today. But we are not predefining what we think Amsterdam is. We're also not asking people, do you only work here, or only visit here, or do you actually live here? Amsterdam becomes an organic entity of people moving in and out. We're not asking people's ethnic background, although we do our best to reach a diversity of people. And we don't predefine what we think the outcome will be. And the outcome has both surprised us, and at the same time confirmed larger patterns that are recognizable. The other possibility that came into being because Amsterdam is the third and last location where the world explained is realized is that we can start making a comparison between the cultural mentalities that came out of each of the three cities as a kind of situated knowledge and understanding of these three places. And it's only now that we're about 3 months into the project that we can start really seeing the cultural pattern coming out of Amsterdam and contrasting that, especially with Sao Paulo. With Barcelona, the distinctions are perhaps less clear. A typical pattern of thought that comes out of Amsterdam goes like this. The question is, what is a moment? And, okay, what evolves is a description of time, how time can be cut up, how a moment is something that can almost be photographed and grasped and remembered just like that. But it will end with saying, if you are aware of moments and you organize them for yourself in a line, they become learning moments. Hence, they benefit me. And this is definitely a pattern that we're getting from the city of Amsterdam. The idea that there are all kinds of phenomena out in the world, but what matters about them is how they relate to me and how I can mold them, shape them, learn how to deal with them so that it benefits my position in the world. And this is, of course, it's a general pattern. It's definitely not the only thing that emanates through the stories from Amsterdam, but it starts, of course, to speak about a society in which the individual takes up a lot of place or sees a lot of agency for themselves, which contrasts quite sharply with some of the stories we got from Sao Paulo, where a typical pattern, for example, would have been in response to a question that would deal with space, somebody would say, personal space can be invaded, and if that happens, you cannot count on the rich to help out with that. Just like that. And so, rather than pointing back to me, it points back to societal structures that are often identified in quite abstract terms. Money, capital, injustice, large forces that are so much larger than the individual that the individual is always up against them. Whereas, let's say, by reading it against Amsterdam, you get almost the opposite feeling of the agency fully belonging to the individual who can mold the world there in their direction. So with these kind of conclusions coming out, it's been very challenging to have this kind of project in a culture museum where there is also a sincere interest from the audience as well to not only take this as a conceptual art piece, as a production of printed matter, as an artist research methodology, but to actually really also look at the content of the stories and the cultural patterns that emanate through them. And that's been really a gain for both Eric and me as a curator to see that that is the potential of a culture museum that can be mobilized in ways that work slightly differently in an arts context, where the audience would have been less prone on really delving into the stories and sharing their own stories as well, and interacting with us and thinking together with us about what the stories mean. Another line in the contemporary arts program that we're developing at the Tropen Museum links much more explicitly to the history of the museum, and especially to the potential of the colonial archive. The Tropen Museum is not just a museum for culture, it's actually a museum that is intimately, historically linked to the Dutch colonial enterprise. It was originally, before it moved into the building in 1910 where it is now, a product museum. In fact, originally even a museum in the form of a train that traveled through the country to show to the Dutch audience the products that were harvested from the colonies and attract investors in intensifying the industries there. You will see most of that kind of history reflected in our photography and film archives that are truly quite amazing and that are kind of dormant and asking for rethinking of what they could mean in the present. One side of that photo archive literally links to this product history. It'll have endless mappings of the natural and agricultural world in Indonesia, so there are pictures of all the stages in which a plant would grow, what diseases they can get, what you can do about them, how you would house the workers, what tools you would use to work on them, how you would house the owners of the plantations, entire wall-filling cabinets of this kind of mapping of what the economic potential was of the colonies. And it's the part of an archive of the museum that the museum itself hasn't been so sure of what to do with it. Our documentalists find that part of the archive the least interesting because they are not very pretty pictures. They seem to belong to a past that is over. Yet at the same time, there is, for me, a wonderful potential to connect that kind of archive with the current interest of a lot of contemporary artists in the effects of globalization on our world, in a world that is changing, where, of course, questions of how labor is organized, how capital flows, how trade lines flow and influence cultures are still very influential. And at the same time, artists can do something with such an archive that maybe the historians or documentalists or the scientists would not do. They can make that speculative leap between the past and the present. And this is exactly what we are now inviting artists to do. So we're setting up a line of commissions with different artists to work with their archives and incorporate them in their own work and thus make connections with the present that can revive the relevance of such an archive in the present, but that can also offer another layer to their work. I'm going to give you one example of that, which is a commission that we're working on right now with the Dutch artist Mathilde Terheyne, who has, since 2006, been working on a work that consists of postcards made of portraits of anonymous women collected from a range of different archives across the world. The portraits are all from the beginning of photography to around 1920 to roughly coincide with the history of the women's movement. And she's going to make a new edition of this work, delving into Arab archives. I'm just going to show you some of the images that she will be working on. One of the things that is truly wonderful about this seemingly simple artistic gesture by Mathilde Terheyne is that she starts breaking down categories that would normally not have been broken down. All the women that come together under this header of anonymous women would normally not have come together because some of these pictures are portraits of established, sometimes even royal figures, nonetheless not preserved with their name. Some are definitely belonging to the category of the scientific efforts to produce ethnic types, so they are typologies, and those typologies are sometimes let's say documentary, but very often they were staged. Women were taken from the street, put into certain costumes, put into certain poses in order to fulfill that picture of what a particular ethnic stereotype would be. Mathilde starts breaking down that category by inserting all these pictures from different backgrounds into one new category, which is together the category of anonymous women. And these are then produced into postcards, presented in about 7 to 10 of these traditional racks that one could put postcards in. And the audience is free to browse and to take their own cards. So what Mathilde in effect is doing with this seemingly simple gesture is that she takes these anonymous women from the archives where they are usually left to be individual because they are anonymous. She doesn't hide the fact that they are linked to a history that made them anonymous in the first place, that made them disappear into those archives in the first place. Yet at the same time, she gives them a renewed visibility and a critical mass by bringing together in such a large group and allowing the audience to take them home, to even send them to others, etc., brings them into renewed circulation and into a new life, one could say, in the present, where they can generate the new meanings in the present without erasing the meanings that they had in the past. What she does on the back of the cards is that each card on the back contains a short biography of a woman who did enter history for the achievement that she made in her society, often in relation to the position of women in that society. The stories on the back are unrelated to the portrait that you see on the other side. So it is really this loose association between the two that also triggers the questioning of the role of women in society, both in relation to figures that we might still know and that are quite famous, as well as to figures of whom we can perhaps never recover what they actually really did, but through this combination they get that kind of visibility again. For me, it's a wonderful example of what an artist can do with a colonial archive with quite simple means, if you wish, which would otherwise be this would simply not be an option for the scientific staff of a museum like this to make these kind of connections of a picture of one woman with a story of a woman that is not that same person, in a way to make historically perhaps incorrect connections in the literal sense, but to mobilize a speculation about history and the present, nonetheless, through this montage. She's the first who's going to work with our archive in this way, and she's going to be the first of many to continue with very different sides of the archive. That's what I had to do.
Thank you very much. Thank you. I wonder if anyone has any questions. I certainly do. I'll ask my question. I guess it's more of a comment that perhaps I can form into a question. But yesterday, Jelle Walvoets gave a presentation about the Stedelijk Museum Bureau, of which he's the head, and he showed this very intriguing image of the cafe, of the restaurant of the Stedelijk Museum with the canoe, which was a loan from the Tropen Museum and was still part of the restaurant up until mid-80s, I think. And it just leads me to kind of speculate, as he was doing on the term global art, and he was asking, what is global art? So that's kind of part one of my question is this a term which is at all useful for you as a contemporary curator within the Tropen Museum? And also, I wonder if, obviously, the context that the artist that you're asking artists to work within is one of a collection, of one of harvesting, as you describe it, these artifacts from a colonial era. And I wonder if, in turn, some of the contemporary commissions would be incorporated into the collection themselves.
I'll start with the second question. Yes, this work, for example, will be part of our collection. And I think, on the one hand, for me, which is slightly different for some of my colleagues, but for me, collecting is a means to an end. At the same time, if you really want to make a difference into a museum like this, you have to make changes in the collection, in what is there permanently. Of course, there's been quite a long history of artists like Fred Wilson, etc., being invited into ethnographic museums to make temporary exhibitions, critical interventions, etc. But if they have no lasting effect, I think that's quite problematic, not just in terms of what is offered to the artist, but also in terms of the status of the ethnographic museum itself, because it means that the museum in itself, in essence, is in a way an unchanging monument to a problematic past that one can make annotations to, that one can make interventions into, but in a way that one cannot fundamentally change. The challenge, and yet of course also the difficulty of what we're trying to do at the Tropen Museum as a curatorial team, is to rethink the role of the museum as a whole in the 21st century. This museum also has had a history of doing that and making quite different decisions over the different decades of reinventing itself. And it's such a huge place with such divergent collections that there is no one easy answer to this. But the challenge is not just to bring in contemporary art as those footnotes or comments on something that in essence remains what it is, but making the collaborations with artists part of a general transformation and growth of the institution. So in that sense, collecting is important. At the same time, what I love about this project is that yes, we will collect it, but it's an edition of three, so the same images will also move out of our museum into other realms, which is really an added value for us in this type of work. The other question related to global art is a more complex one. Global art is becoming a very hot, almost, and yet at the same time highly contested term. And I think those kind of discussions inhabit a space like the Tolkien Museum in a different way than they inhabit the Ark Museum, because in a way they are two sides of the same coin, historically. Of course, historically there was a separation between what counted as art, which ended up in the Ark Museum, and which came out of very specific geographic regions, and what ended up in an ethnographic museum. And about 15 years ago, when the Tolkien Museum hosted a conference on global art, together with the Ark Museum in the Netherlands, the outcome of that symposium was very simply that the Ark Museum said, well, non-Western art belongs to you, not to us. So the distinction was very strict. In the meantime, a lot has changed in terms of that distinction. There are ethnographic museums who literally say, we focus on mapping global art and on giving privilege to artists that are not visible within the museum world. This is, for example, what the Africa Museum in Bergendal does. I find it an understandable position. At the same time, it's a problematic position in this type of museum. One of the reasons for bringing in Enid Beltran's encyclopedia, for example, is my response and his response to the encyclopedic impulse that has shaped this type of museum so much in the 19th century. I think it would be a mistake to try to update that same encyclopedic impulse, not only because not one museum can afford financially to even try to begin to collect an overview of what one could now call global art, but has to make really precise choices within that, but also because the very idea that there is a power center that can be the place where this encyclopedic overview of the global could be collected would, in our environment, immediately be read as a neo-colonial effort. So sometimes a museum like this actually makes the frictions in those new ways of thinking come out in a more sharp way, and they become immediately impossibilities in this kind of environment. So for us, it was really crucial, and I was very happy with this as the ground on which I could step into this museum, that ethnic identity is not a basis anymore for inviting artists. It doesn't mean that sometimes we work with artists that deal with themes that are connected to questions about ethnic identity, that's fine, but it doesn't become the ground anymore, which it used to be. So we inhabit this question of the global in a slightly different way. Of course, we're very aware of the need to show very different ways of working, to pay attention to specific historical and contemporary realities. But within this notion of the impossible, I think, gesture of such an encyclopedic effort, for us the term global art is difficult.
One of the questions kind of almost answered with the, I was going to ask you about exactly what kind of brief you're given within the museum to, is it more like a, exactly what you were saying about that you don't have the need to work with distinction, like I have to do the Dutch artists, I have to do, you know, within the program of the year, if you have that kind of brief. And I wonder, in turn, what kind of brief you give to the artists when you invite them? Is it a blank card, an invitation of come to the Tropen Museum and exactly do what you want? Or you obviously invite someone with the idea that what happened in response is obviously the idea, but I wonder if that's something that you are able to give the artists when you have them.
My brief, in a way, for me as a curator, contemporary art in the setting, which was a new role that didn't exist before, is actually quite open. After decades of sometimes individual interest by the existing culture curators in acquiring art or bringing in art, there was really a desire to try to find a structural role for art in this place, which was first of all translated into having a curator there. And the brief is really open in the sense that it is about finding a place for art in this setting, and a way of working with art, and of course bringing in a new audience as well. I immediately, that's the first thing I did, changed the attitude from bringing in art to bringing in artists. Because I think it's crucial to bring in artists to think together with us what makes sense in a place like this, both in terms of the kind of subjects and themes that we want to work with, but actually also in terms of making the work speak in such an environment. I didn't include these pictures now, but you have to imagine that a museum for culture not only has the kind of ethnographic artifacts that you would imagine, we have actually quite a lot of popular culture, contemporary as well. But there is, for example, a tradition that I think goes back to the diorama, of sort of creating settings, so not focusing on individual objects, but creating textures and settings, almost sometimes with sort of landscape associations connected to them. How to inhabit such a space is really something that requires the artist and the curator to work together. It's an environment where just looking for artists to deal with themes that are relevant in this kind of context is not enough. It also has to speak a language that can make a difference there, rather than disappear into what is already there. So it was, for example, a very conscious choice with Eric's project, apart from the interest in the encyclopedic impulse that he was rethinking and in establishing an image around Sudan culture, to opt for an artist who didn't work with images. So he doesn't work with images. And the medium in this case was text, and there is actually, I mean, there are small illustrations sometimes, but there's quite a deliberate absence of images to not depict in a picture the mentality of Amsterdam, but to describe it and to allow the audience themselves to come up with their own images. And in a museum that is so abundant with the effort to picture what cultures and places are, it was very relevant to actually make that difference, for example, in this case. So when I invite artists, I tend to invite them not just for their general practice, but with very specific works or lines of interest in mind.
I have a question about this is in relation between contemporary art and anthropological museums. In the show that there is now in Middelburg that I did, and I will present after you, there is a work by Sarah van der Heijden, and it's the 24th anthropological museum in Europe. And it's quite interesting, this work, because in a certain way there's a description of a consciousness about a European identity of the rest of the world by the art itself. So making this very interesting relation between an anthropological museum and a context for contemporary art. And in a certain way, I was wondering if in this moment where the Eurocentric culture is getting less strong than in the past, and there is this, you know, this cultural globalization, which means that Europe is not anymore really the center. And this work, in a certain way, displays that these museums are something very particular about these moments of changes for European culture. What do you think will happen to an institution like yours in Amsterdam in the following years? What do you think which perspective will take with this loss of a kind of center, where also this kind of museums that will it's possible that we have in a few years, in a few decades, a European museum in Asia or in America? Or what do you think is happening in the coming years in this museum institution?
I'll try to answer that question without going into the whole funding discussion that is playing now as well. But I know what will happen in this museum in the near future is that the traditional geographic organization of this museum, so not only is the collection display linked to identified regions, like I said, so there's a Middle East section, a Latin America section, etc., certain section of course are absent. This will make place for a thematic approach, and a thematic approach would allow us much more freedom into making cross connections between any kind of places that are relevant for a particular question. So that's one, that's internal, but I think it's quite significant in dislocating this kind of power mapping that traditionally meant that the empty center Europe would look at the rest of the world, which you can still see in the structure of such a museum, including in the staff, because except for me, everybody else is a region specialist. Which, there's an Arabist, the other thing that will happen, but has actually a solid history in this museum, is international collaboration. And interestingly enough, this museum particularly has that connection because since it was originally 100 years ago a colonial museum, it still, until next year, is funded from foreign affairs, not from culture. And that means that it has historically been very connected to what we now neatly call capacity building projects elsewhere. And the museum has also been part of that in setting up, for example, helping set up masters in curating in Jakarta, or help develop local museums in different places that we have historical connections with. This international relation will continue, but will shift and have to shift from this idea of capacity building, which is exactly connected to this idea of the knowledge center exporting its knowledge elsewhere, to collaborations. And it sometimes triggers interesting questions also. For example, we're just starting a collaboration with the Museum of Art in Singapore. And they are, of course, very interested in nation building and in starting a new collection and a new structure for their displays and their exhibitions that somehow asks questions about Southeast Asia and its identity. Now, on the one hand, you could say we don't want to have anything to do with such identity politics. At the same time, it's not like such identity politics is absent from Europe or Holland by far at the moment. But it will be very interesting for us to see what can come out of a collaboration between an institution that has a 100-year history and tries to rethink that in the present, and an institution that starts up right now. And so maybe part of the future is in those kind of collaborations, which also allow different kind of exhibitions and thematic organizations of the collection to come out. This is larger than the contemporary arts program within this museum, of course. But that's one of the things I see. Another thing that is happening in the ethnographic museums across Europe is that they start joint research projects to dig up exactly that in their collections that was previously deemed to be uninteresting because it was not fulfilling the old criteria of speaking about the most authentic images of culture, which is of course by now a by far outdated view on what culture is and how it works. So they have actually started as a big network across Europe to go from one museum to the next, to go through the depots, which usually host about 90% of the collection, to look exactly at those objects that are hybrid and can speak about the connections that were there between cultures all along. So those are kind of very ethnographic museum specific developments. There is a possibility, I think, and it's always good to keep that in mind, that in 200 years this type of museum simply has no need to exist anymore and will dissolve into something else. And that's not necessarily something to be sad about. It has to do with shifting parameters. This type of museum was built in a world that was a different world. And for example, its relation with art, the separation of museum for culture and museum for art, is not just challenged within the ethnographic world, but it's very much also challenged from the art world at the moment, with a growing, growing number of artists and curators interested in history and understanding culture through art. That's where I tap into this discussion.